Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the power of digital technology to promote the Christian message. Archbishop Claudio Celi returns from a visit to India and Bangladesh, where he was encouraged by the work of the church in the communications ministry. The new head of the Orthodox Church in Serbia appeals for dialogue, reconciliation and closer relations with the Catholic Church. And we present episode 30 of our weekly radio drama, The Vatican Centuries. Power of digital technology to promote the Christian message, even in countries where the church is a tiny minority. That was the focus of Archbishop Claudio Celi's visit to India and Bangladesh in mid-February. The head of the Vatican's Council for Social Communications took part in a seminar organized by the Catholic Bishops' Conference of India and visited their communications training center before traveling on to Dhaka for 2 days and visiting the seminary there. At the heart of Archbishop Celi's message to the church leaders, priests and lay people in both countries was the challenge of communicating God's love for all people, whatever their cultural, ethnic or religious background. In New Delhi, he presided at the launch of 3 books and DVD resources on communications training for seminarians in India, the first such work by a national church to include theological, philosophical and practical media formation for future priests and religious. On his return to Rome, Archbishop Celi told me more about this important visit.
I was working for 2 days with the Episcopal Commission for Social Communication. The commission is presided by Cardinal Gracias of Mumbai. And there present the Archbishop of New Delhi and other bishops of India, but mainly all the people working in the field of communications all around India. 2 days, very busy, but I would say enriching, because I could perceive what the Indian community is doing in the field of communication. One of the points of this meeting was the publication and the launching of 3 volumes for the formation of future priests in communication. It is not a book just to teach how to deal with the new technologies, but is a real formation in the field of communication. It means to help people to understand what it means today to communicate inside the church. And I think that is the first time that inside in the church we are publishing 3 volumes for the formation of the future priests. And I must congratulate the Indian Episcopal Conference, because it is already something. Certainly it can be improved in the future, but I think that it is already a positive step.
It's also responding to Pope Benedict's request in his message for social communications, isn't it?
Exactly. The Holy Father, in the message of this year, is stressing the point of formation of the future priests in communication. And I think that these 3 volumes are not responding to the request of the Holy Father, because the project started some years ago. But I would say that in the context of the message of the Holy Father, this is already a positive sign. I can tell you that, for example, going to Bangladesh, I brought with me the 3 volumes, and I entrusted them to the rector of the National Seminary in Dhaka, because I think that also the Bangladesh future priests, they need to be prepared to communicate what they have in their heart. And for me, this is the main aspect. India certainly is moving on a different level. They are very active in all the states. And especially where the Catholic community is more relevant, I can say that you can perceive what they produce. Magazines, programs for the radio, programs for the television, and I would say we products of a certain quality. So really I was appreciative of what the Episcopal Conference in India is doing in this field, and especially the Episcopal Commission for Social Communications.
In many of the states, though, as you say, the church is not a majority. In fact, it's a very small minority,
and therefore
there's a great need for sensitivity towards communications as a form of dialogue.
We were stressing quite clearly that the presence of the church in the field of communication is not a moment of proselytism. But the church has to communicate the word of God, to announce what we have in our heart. It is something that we are receiving and something that it is entrusted to us, to our care, but something that we have to proclaim and to announce to the people of today. And I think that the Catholic community in India is quite well involved in such a pastoral activity.
And yet this pastoral activity can perhaps be a difficult or dangerous task if we think of the areas of India where there have been such sectarian violence.
It is true, but I would say that the Catholic community is using a respectful attitude. We are not making propaganda or proselytism. But we cannot be silent. I am always accustomed to make a reference to a text of St. Paul in his letter, in his second letter to the Corinthians, where Paul says that we are collaborators of your joy. And I think that the church, with its communicative activity, must collaborate to the joy of the people of today. If a human being is walking in the streets of today and on many occasions is finding solitude, loneliness, and difficulties, I like to repeat to myself what Paul was saying. We are collaborators of the joy of our people. And I think that this is a great message of consolation for the human beings of today.
When you went to Bangladesh, you found really a great difficulty of the church there, given the very small financial means that it has for this ministry.
You know, the situation of the church in Bangladesh is like that one of the other people. It's a poor country with very big economical difficulties. But as I was saying before, I was impressed by the involvement, the dedication, also with the poor means that they have at their disposal. But I think that the church in Bangladesh has the courage to announce the message of Jesus Christ in an attitude of respect and dialogue. I was pleased to find in the production center in Dhaka people who were not belonging to the Christian faith. They were Muslims, they were Buddhists, and this I think is positive. It means that there is a concrete sign of a deep respect, but at the same time the fact must be underlined that also with the poor medias, they think that their mission to communicate the word of God is continuing, and it is a challenge for everybody.
You also took a computer, didn't you, to the seminary as a small token, a small sign of encouragement in this work with new technology?
Yes, when I was in the National Seminary, I was appreciating the dedication of the young seminarians, but certainly you were touching with your hands the difficulties. And so I thought that the best way to give a souvenir of my visit was to give them a new computer. Because I think that, and this was also one of the messages, to not be late tomorrow in the dialogue of the church with the new technologies. Because little by little also Bangladesh will run in the field of the social communications with the new technologies. And so my idea is always this, that the church has not to be late, but we have to take seriously and concretely our pastoral ministry in the digital continent, also in Bangladesh.
Thanks there to Archbishop Claudio Celi, President of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications. The new head of the Serbian Orthodox Church has made an appeal for dialogue to overcome the long-standing divisions with the Catholic Church. Patriarch Irinej was elected and installed in Belgrade on January the 23rd as the 45th leader of the Serbian Orthodox Church, which counts about 11 million members worldwide. Noting that the year 2013 marks the 1,700th anniversary of the Edict of Milan, establishing religious freedom throughout the Roman Empire, the Patriarch said it's time to overcome past divisions and take a new Christian road. Though Christians split into East and Western churches in 1054 and no pope has ever visited Serbia, Irinej suggested the anniversary could be marked by both churches in the Serbian city of Nice, birthplace of Constantine, one of the two Roman emperors who issued the Edict of Milan. Papal spokesman Father Federico Lombardi said the suggestion was welcomed with great joy in the Vatican.
With the high respect that the Serbian church has within Serbian society, obviously he becomes a crucial, not only religious figure, but social figure, a figure in national life. So this is a very high profile position.
Felix Corley is editor of Forum 18 News Service. He talked to my colleague Ema McCarthy about the new Serbian patriarch and about the future of his church's relations with the rest of the Christian world.
Well, he'll be 80 later in 2010. He's actually, like the late Patriarch Pavle, he's really lived through so many upheavals throughout his life. He was born in what was the Kingdom of Serbia, in central Serbia itself, but he's served in what is now Kosovo, a state which the Serbian Orthodox Church and the Serbian state do not recognize. He studied in Greece with the World Council of Churches scholarship in his time. He'd also been in the monastery in what is now the independent state of Montenegro. And obviously he's lived through the communist period as well, the Nazi occupation before that, so the communist period, then the post-communist turmoil within Serbia, Milosevic's regime. He's lived through the Balkan Wars, obviously the more recent conflict over Kosovo. So he's had quite a turbulent his country has lived through quite turbulent times, and he's served the church through all this. And he's probably not the most high profile of the candidates who could have been chosen. Now, quite interestingly, the Serbian Orthodox Church since 1967 has used what they call the apostolic choice, i.e. the three main candidates who've been agreed by all the bishops of the church as the three sort of top-ranking candidates. Their names are put into an envelope into separate envelopes inside a copy of the Bible, and they are actually chosen by lot. Now, this was introduced in 1967 to prevent the communist authorities from more or less nominating or pressuring the church to adopt their favored candidate. This has really, in this sense today, come up really with an unexpected choice. He's probably the least likely of the three to have won election in a ballot, a direct ballot of all the voters. And many people believe the Metropolitan Amfilohije of Montenegro would have been the one. He's known as a very hardline Serbian nationalist who does not believe in ecumenical contacts with other Christian churches, very much someone who believes that the Serbian people should be united in one state. He was a supporter, very vigorous supporter of Karadzic and the Bosnian Serbs during the war. Now, Bishop Irinej of Niš is less visible in that kind of capacity. He's seen as a much more moderate candidate, and he will have to take forward the church trying to redefine its role in the new Serbia.
As you said, he's described as a moderate candidate. What hopes are there for continuing or indeed improving ecumenical dialogue with the other churches, even though they are in a minority in Serbia, and indeed with their fellow churches beyond Serbian borders, given the election of Bishop Irinej?
Well, the religious minorities in Serbia have had a very difficult time in recent years. There's been a lot of physical attacks on them, mainly on Protestants, on Jehovah's Witnesses, on the very small Hare Krishna community, and on Muslims as well. There's a large Muslim minority in Serbia, and they've been subject to attacks. There's been a lot of vigorous rhetoric against them in the media. Many of the government agencies, especially the religion ministry, is very close to various factions of the Serbian Orthodox Church. Now, obviously, the Bishop Irinej, now Patriarch Irinej, won't want to disentangle close ties with the state, but it remains to be seen whether he will try to prevent this quasi state-sponsored or state-sanctioned or tolerated attacks on religious minorities, whether he'll distance the church from that kind of negative, aggressive role or people claiming to act in the name of the church, aggressive role against religious minorities, whether he will support a tolerant, open society where ethnic minorities, even, for example, homosexuals, have had a very difficult time, been criticized and attacked by priests and senior clergymen, and had a very difficult time in the country. Will he be looking forward to more open society, or will he be looking backwards to try to keep Serbia as what people would like to see as a monolithic, Orthodox, traditional, nationalist, inward-looking country? Another question that he will also have to deal with, and one which has international implications, is the role of the Serbian Orthodox Church in Macedonia. And Bishop Irinej personally had responsibility for overseeing the activity of the Serbian Orthodox Church in Macedonia in the last few years. The communist authorities and people within Macedonia organized a breakaway Orthodox Church, which has never been recognized by the wider Orthodox world. They've been on-off sort of dialogues with the Macedonian Orthodox over the years, but they haven't really got anywhere. Now, a couple of years ago, the Serbian Orthodox decided to set up its own parallel jurisdiction again within Macedonia, and this has suffered a lot from the Macedonian state, which has backed the Macedonian Orthodox, and the leader, Bishop Jovan, has been imprisoned several times on what the Macedonians say are trumped-up charges. Now, what will Bishop Irinej do? He obviously has to try to rally the other Orthodox churches to back the Serbian claims against the Macedonians, to try to prevent any other Orthodox churches from recognizing the autocephaly or independence of the Macedonian Orthodox Church. But will he pursue a track of dialogue, or will he pursue a track of rebuilding parallel structures, more or less saying, we've given up on dialogue with the Macedonian Orthodox, we will establish Serbian Orthodox diocese within Macedonia?
Finally, Felix, what is the position regarding the Serbian Orthodox Church in relation to the other Orthodox churches? I'm thinking here of the Patriarchate of Moscow. I'm thinking of the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople.
Well, the Orthodox world is sort of in the middle of a kind of cold war, really, one could say, between the Ecumenical Patriarchate in Istanbul, in Constantinople, and the Moscow Patriarchate. The Moscow Patriarchate is by far the biggest. It outnumbers all the other Orthodox churches in terms of members put together. So it's a massive influence in the Orthodox world. You've seen a resurgence of that church, and it's the church is sort of throwing its weight around internationally, you might say. I think the Serbians, they emotionally, Serbs feel quite close to Russians, but I think they would be sort of more, they'd be on the sidelines and be more of a kind of balancing influence, I think, trying not to back one against the other either way.
Thanks there to Felix Corley, editor of Forum 18 News Service. And now we present the next instalment of our weekly radio drama, The Vatican Centuries, looking back at the people and places that made up the history of the Vatican. The series was written by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. Today's episode 30 is entitled Reformation.
The long reign of the humanists was coming to an end. Fascination with the classical past had waned, and when the joyous carnival in the capital of Christendom was cut short by the sack of Rome, an epoch of decadence set in.
The 16th century went into its third decade with Charles V as Holy Roman Emperor. And in June 1520, a treaty was signed between Henry VIII and Francis I at a spectacular meeting at the Field of the Cloth of Gold. This celebrated diplomatic event produced no results, and the following year war blazed between France and Spain.
In Rome, the construction of the new St. Peter's was making heavy demands, and in 1516, Pope Leo extended the Peter indulgence into Germany. Dominican friar Tetzel was appointed to preach.
It was a match to a bonfire. In 1517, Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the door of the castle church in Wittenberg. The Reformation was alight.
The gay Leonine Carnival came to an abrupt end in 1521, when Pope Leo was struck down by pneumonia. His successor, Adrian VI, the last non-Italian pope until our own day, only reigned a year. He was followed by Clement VII.
There had been a lull in the building work on the new St. Peter's. Clement, like Adrian, tried to keep costs down, but was worried by alarmist echoes coming from Germany as a result of the application of a bull issued in 1510 by Julius II, conceding special favours, in special circumstances, to those who made offerings for the rebuilding of St. Peter's.
Clement's time was an unhappy one for Rome. Even the atmosphere was heavy. On the morning of May the 6th, 1527, a thick fog followed the sunrise. Under cover of this, the imperial army of Charles V advanced to attack Rome. It was an army of desperate men, all unpaid mercenaries, thirsty for loot. As they stormed the Borgo, the Pope, dressed in full pontificals, was on his knees in St. Peter's, determined to meet the enemy with dignity.
But when the marauding armies swept through the frightened city, they met little resistance. They burst into the hospital of Santo Spirito and massacred the patients in their beds. The screams of the dying and the roar of the cannon could be heard on the steps of St. Peter's. The Pope was finally convinced to make his escape along the Passetto, the covered corridor leading to Castel Sant'Angelo. Had he stayed long enough to say three creeds, wrote an eyewitness, he would have been taken.
For 8 days, while the invading armies pillaged, burned, and slaughtered, the Pope was beleaguered in the castle, together with 13 cardinals and a group of 90 Swiss and 400 Italians. St. Peter's was overrun with the Bourbon army. They lounged on the altars, drank from precious chalices, stabled their horses in the sanctuary, and filled their litters with precious manuscripts. St. Peter's was desecrated. Shrines and tombs were rifled, and the veil of Veronica was dragged from tavern to tavern amid the ribald taunts of the soldiery. In the city, every kind of sacrilege and barbarity was perpetrated. The Saracens had been mild in comparison.
An enormous ransom was asked for the Pope. Benvenuto Cellini had sewn the jewels from the papal tiara into the Pope's robes, but these too had to go. Eventually, the Pope capitulated. A few months later, he left Rome disguised as a market gardener. Three years later, the unhappy pontiff was obliged to crown Charles V, the man who had humiliated him and left Rome in ruins, as Holy Roman Emperor. Clement died in 1534 and is buried in a magnificent porphyry urn taken from the Pantheon.
An eyewitness of the sack of Rome was the humanist Cardinal Saloleto. In his sober comment on the event, he demonstrates the new spirit of reform in church and state.
If through our suffering a satisfaction is made to the wrath and justice of God, if these fearful punishments again open the way to better laws and morals, then is our misfortune perhaps not of the greatest. What belongs to God, he will take care of. Before us lies a life of reformation, which no violence can take from us. Let us so rule our deeds and thoughts as to seek in God only the true glory of the priesthood and our own true greatness and power.
The demand for reform was nothing new. The age was deeply religious. But no single man occupying the See of Peter at that time possessed the vision or the strength to reform the church from within.
When Martin Luther published his 95 Theses, he was nearing 34. He'd been an Augustinian friar for 12 years and had recently adopted a simplified theology based on his reading of St. Paul. It became known as justification by faith. For Luther, man depended on God's mercy and could not buy his way to heaven by giving alms or performing good works. The sale of indulgences enraged Luther, and he determined to expose the scandal, confident that the Pope would support him.
At first, Leo X paid little attention to the Wittenberg affair, believing it to be a monkish squabble, and merely told the head of the Austin friars to keep his men in order. But copies of Luther's theses had circulated rapidly, and popular support for him was growing. The Pope sent Cardinal Cajetan, general of the Dominican Order, to hear Luther. He ordered him to retract his theses. Luther refused. In a public confrontation with Dominican scholar John Eck, Luther denied papal supremacy.
There was now no turning back. Luther published pamphlet after pamphlet, moving further and further away from his original invitation to debate an abuse. In 1520, he published three manifestos, one of which attacked the sacramental system.
Rome could no longer ignore Martin Luther. On the 15th of June 1520, the Pope issued a bull, Exsurge Domine, condemning 41 of Luther's propositions as heretical, ordering the faithful to burn his books and giving Luther 2 months to recant or be excommunicated. Luther responded by burning the bull in public.
Finally, in 1521, Luther was called before the Emperor Charles V at the Diet of Worms. Asked once more to revoke his writings, Luther refused. He was outlawed on the spot. Given a safe conduct, he lived for 10 months in disguise in the castle of Wartburg.
Luther's doctrine was formulated officially in 1530 in the Confession of Augsburg. He compiled a catechism, wrote hymns, and by 1534 had finished his translation of the Bible into German. By the time he died in 1546, the principles of the Reformation were widely established.
You've been listening to episode 30 of The Vatican Centuries, written by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. You can hear the next episode at this same time next week. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Don't forget you can find all our news and feature programmes on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio, Laudato Jesus Christus.